So this is the second half of the third seminar on writing the history of the First World War. And we've more or less got to the end of the three fields of history. These are the last questions, rather biased questions to ask about cultural history. Firstly, is cultural history only concerned with what people have in their head? Well, not necessarily. I mean, it can be about cultural practices. And secondly, where does people's culture come from? Now, the Marxists would say that social being determines consciousness. That is to say, what you live in your life, your consciousness comes from your concrete experience. Yeah. If you have to work on the land as a peasant in order to feed your family, you will have the ideas which match your situation. If you work in a modern society, a 21st century society, where you will probably, here is the bad news, you will probably have to work for a boss for wages. That's what people do. And when you're in that situation, you have ideas and culture which match your situation. This is the Marxist view, where the most important thing is the production and reproduction of everyday life. Yeah. For a Marxist, if you want to understand a society, you start with production. So you walk into this room from another planet. If you have a Marxist Martian who arrives in this room, the first thing they would say is, this is a table. Who made it? Who bought it? You have clothes. Who made them? Do you make them, or do you make something to exchange for these tables and these clothes? That's what a Marxist would be interested in first, the production and reproduction of everyday life. Now, historians are, they're not necessarily anti-Marxists. They may be Marxists too, but they're mostly interested in representation. And then at the bottom, as I already mentioned, What do social and cultural historians have in common? And that is probably an interest in history from below, history of ordinary people, because it seems that in the 21st century, or since the 1970s in particular, it is no longer possible, at least in universities, it is more difficult today, as I was saying, to say, oh, I'm not interested in ordinary people, I just want to study the kings. And that doesn't go down too well. This is democratic spirit for you. Okay, so there you have the military historians, the diplomatic historians, the political historians, the social historians, the cultural historians. They're all working. And there are other areas of history besides the First World War, but the First World War remains today an extremely productive area. There's lots of them around. And they don't always agree. And there has been, with the arrival of the centenary, there have been a number of debates in Britain. And in particular, there have been a series of historians in Britain, a series of conservative historians in Britain, who have been very worried about the general image of the First World War, and have been writing history books to show what they think is the other side. And they call themselves revisionist historians. And ne pas confondre avec les révisionnistes de la Deuxième Guerre, qui ça n'a rien à voir. But revisionist historians, that is to say that they consider that the general opinion of the First World War is wrong. That's why they call themselves revisionists. And they consider, probably correctly, that the general opinion of the First World War is that the generals were not very good and didn't care about how many soldiers died. The revisionist historians, people like Corrigan, Niall Ferguson, William Philpott, Gary Sheffield, they look at the cinema and they look at the television series, and these all give a negative view. They're no longer about the glorious First World War. And so they try to correct this. And I think I have a couple of examples here. I'll come back to that. Sorry, that's later. That's later. I did have a couple of examples, but I don't. Now, they haven't been very successful. They're very influential, these revisionist historians. For example, if you go to the BBC History site, the website BBC History. Now, as you can imagine, if you're a historian and the BBC phones you up and they say, we want you to write our website, you are a very happy historian. And the BBC website is one of the most prestigious websites in the world. If you have an argument on Facebook with people and they say, I saw in Wikipedia this, and you can say, I saw in the BBC this, you usually win. It's extremely respected. And the revisionist historians have a lot of influence on important sites like that. However, it seems that they're not very successful, because there was an opinion poll in 2014, and it asked people what they thought. What do you think of the following sentence, it said? British troops in World War I were badly served by their generals, who made poor strategic decisions and needlessly wasted thousands of lives in pointless attacks. So that was the sentence. So a very negative sentence about the generals. How many people agreed with that, do you think? 52%. 52% of the people polled agreed with that. How many people had a positive view of the generals of the First World War? 17%. So it looks like the revisionist historians who've been working very hard for 15 years have not been very successful in persuading people that that the First World War was. Well, in general, what they want to say is the First World War was, one, necessary, and secondly, well organized. That's the role of the revisionist generals. Not very successful. Why? I don't know why, but I suspect that family memory may be more important than official histories. I don't know, you may have some experience of this. Perhaps your grandparents talked to you about the Second World War? Not really. Very often people don't talk about wars because it's depressing, yeah? But if you imagine that your grandparents talked to you about the Second World War, I think you can probably understand why what your grandparents said would be very important to you, yeah? And it would be easier for you to believe it than some historian, you know. And family history is very, 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 very important. My grandmother didn't talk about the First World War. There was only one thing she ever said about it. She said, I remember them telling me of the young boys crying for their mothers as they went over the top to attack. Just one sentence. But, yeah, it's not a sentence you forget when your grandmother says that to you, you know. And you need a lot of conservative historians to tell you your grandmother was wrong. That's a very, very powerful thing. We were very lucky in my family, because I think it's because they were bad soldiers, but none of my great-grandparents were killed in the First World War or the Second World War. I think we hid some, probably. But very, very wise idea. Okay, so this debate is still going on. In France, the debate about the First World War has been a little different. In Britain, the debate, or really the argument, because it was very impolite often, in Britain the debate was, were the generals heartless idiots? Yeah? And secondly, was the First World War necessary? And thirdly, was the First World War the fault of Germany? Those were the three big political questions that everybody talked about, even if they didn't read history books. In France, it was different. In France, there's been a big debate for 20 years around the question of a culture of patriotism. That one group of historians organized around the Historiel de Péronne said the most important thing is that there was a culture of patriotic acceptance. That mostly people were convinced, people in the First World War were convinced about the First World War. And another group of historians organized around the CRID, the Centre de Recherche et Information, je ne sais pas quoi, the CRID, they said, no, really, people were pushed, pressured, constrained, obliged. Now, so did people accept voluntarily, or were they pressured or obliged? Now, I mean, it's obvious that it was a bit of both, but this was the crystallized argument in France for 20 years, and it could get very vicious. There was a time when if you were on the wrong side, well, it happened to me. I wrote to, so I would like to present a paper about popular song in your conference. And they said no. And when I saw the program, all of the participants were in the same school of historians. Yeah, they don't invite anybody who might disagree with them. So that can happen. But it's all calmed down a bit now. Everybody's began being nice to each other again. Okay, so... so much for the debates. Okay, so after the debates, there was one more thing I wanted to say. Yes, so this opens up the question of what priority for historians, that if you look at the historians, you have to have an opinion about what is the correct mix, you know, how important are these different questions that they are asking. And Eric Hobsbawm, who was one of the great British historians who wrote social and political history. He wrote a series of books, starting the history from the 1780s, I think, the Age of Capital, the Age of Industry, the Age of Empire. That's the 18th and 19th century. And then for the 20th century, he wrote a new book, the Age of... What would you do with the 20th century? 1914 to 1992, the Age of... the 20th century, the Age of Extremes, which I think is a reasonable description of the 20th century. In any case, when he was interviewed in 2008 and they asked him about cultural history, and this is what he had to say. He said, "There's no question that our generation in the 1950s and 1960s, while they did not completely neglect culture, did not actually give it sufficient weight in our analyses. I think this must be so." Yeah, so in the 50s and 60s, this is the time when social history was dominating, and people were very, very interested in the statistics, the social groups and so on, and culture was not so important. I suspect that today the opposite extreme has come out, and, you know, I sometimes find that, you know, when was the last... I don't see enough statistics in my history books these days. And the second thing is he did make a little bit of a complaint. He says he's not too convinced by the cultural turn. La montée de la culture, l'histoire culturelle, on parle du tournant culturel, the cultural turn. This is what he said. The main trouble about the cultural turn is that an awful lot of it, not pas tout, I mean, an awful lot, a lot of it tends to move away, not merely from the social element in history, but also from the real history. For instance, the enormous range of studies of memory in the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s and 2000s, which are quite new, which did not happen in our day. Well, memory is about today. Memory isn't about what happened. It's about what people later on think happened. So Eric Hobsbawm is being a little bit critical. He's saying, you know, is it really history? Is it really history? Well, that's an open question. You can have whatever opinion suits you on that. And if we move over to the French thinkers, I looked at for a book in French, L'Histoire culturelle by Pascal Horry. So a whole book, 128 pages, just to define cultural history, you know, just define 128 pages. And this is what he says about it. So here's a more positive view. L'histoire culturelle méfiante a priori envers les interprétations unifiées qui mettent en scène un homme simplifié et rationnel et l'infatigable avocat d'un être humain traversé et parfois animé par les contradictions internes. And I thought that was a very interesting quotation, because it's one of the elements would be to move, if you're looking at the history of representations, how do you see the world, then you're moving away from this idea that people think, oh, what shall I do now? And then they do it, yeah? That people act in a rational way to their interests. Whereas, in fact... acting and thinking in contradictory ways is extremely typical. That's what human beings typically do, be contradictory, as you see in politics or in other ways as well. And notice that he puts together this idea of rejecting the grand narrative, les interprétations unifiées, because he says, you know, that they simplify human beings too much. And so the cultural historian, he likes the idea, yeah, he's a supporter of cultural history, and he says cultural history presents human beings who are more complex, who are contradictory, I think that's very important. I mean, if you're abroad and people say, "Oh, what do French people think about Emmanuel Macron?" People often, when you go abroad, people ask you this question. And the problem is, it's kind of contradictory. You can't really say, concerning Emmanuel Macron, this is what French people think. You can't really do that because there's so much going on at the same time. We would like to. Now, at the same time as the rise of cultural history, one of the advantages of the rise of cultural history, anyway, is that it involved in history a whole number of people from other disciplines. I already mentioned this, that you've got people who specialise in literature working in history, people who specialise in psychology working in history. And there are things we don't like about this, but one of the good things is that they reminded historians that it's not enough to find interesting truths about the past, you have to be able to write. You have to find ways of making people interested, and I'll be looking at this next week as well. You have to find ways of making people interested in history. Now, this can be extreme, yeah? You can open... I think there's a couple of Twitter accounts for First World War soldiers imagining that a First World War soldier 100 years ago had a Twitter account, and every day they tweet what the soldier was doing and thinking exactly 100 years ago. And I think that's pretty good. I think that's pretty clever, yeah? Because I'm sure that you would be much more likely to add this to your Twitter account than to go to find a book about the First World War and read it, which is harder, yeah? Of course, films, television series, etc., although some of them have stopped doing that in a way. Game of Thrones is fascinating because it's about history and it's not about history. It's supposed to be. Do people watch Game of Thrones? Put your hand up if you've seen Game. Oh yeah, the people know Game of Thrones because it. Of course, it's supposed to be an imaginary place. But where do all the elements of the imagination come from? Directly from a view of history. It's obviously medieval. There are no atom bombs. There are no submachine guns. It's very clear. Game of Thrones works because of our view of history. There are books, historians write books about Game of Thrones these days. Not me, I'm afraid. I'm not mad keen on Game of Thrones. It's a bit too much for me. In any case, the whole question of how to communicate history has been coming up. And there have been a couple of new ideas coming out. And here you have a couple of new tendencies. First of all, here on the right, Gary Sheffield is one of these conservative historians, but he has found a new way to deal with the First World War in 100 objects, and it's like a picture of an object, 3 pages of writing, another object, 3 pages of writing. It's 100 objects which help you understand the First World War. Now, the advantage, this is very modern, it's like Kamaha Café or what's the other one, the very short sketches, yeah? Because it is, you've got a book, The First World War and 100 Objects, you don't have to begin at the beginning and go to the end. You can just, oh, that looks interesting, let's read 2 pages about it. Yeah, so it's a way of communicating. There'll be more of these. Somebody then did a history of the world in 100 objects, a history of Ireland in 100 objects. And if I ever get time, I'm hoping to write the history of the First World War in 100 songs. So I'm the person who's got... Don't you write it, I want to write that one. Thank you. Okay. And so that's one way of making the book easier. Obviously, the more people read your book, the happier. And here's another side to it. Very big rise in tracing your great war ancestors, a guide for family historians. And a remarkable number of people, even in France, especially in America, and especially in Britain, but even in France, a remarkable number of people are interested in what their great-grandparents did during the First World War. This kind of book will help you find the information about your ancestors in the First World War. On va faire un petit sondage. Qui s'intéresse absolument pas à ce qu'a pu faire le arrière grand-père pendant la Première Guerre mondiale? Ok. Qui irait voir s'il y avait un cousin qui avait trouvé l'information? Qui irait voir parce que c'est quand même un peu intéressant. Ok. Qui serait motivé pour faire des recherches pour savoir ce qu'a fait les ancêtres pendant la Première Guerre? Okay, quand même. Okay. Comme quoi, même en France, hein, même en France, aux États-Unis, c'est une religion nationale, chercher ce qu'ont fait vos ancêtres. Hein. But even in France, I think it is rising. And you'll find, if you look on Amazon, there's loads of books about that. That's interesting. Quite a few of you would like to know. Yes. I did have one grandfather in the army. He was in the British Army in Ireland in 1919. When the Irish and the English were fighting, and unfortunately, in my opinion, he was on the wrong side. What can you do? I put those there. Yeah, those are just four of the best sellers. Four of the best sellers of the recent. Not so recent, really. Four of the best sellers are André Lhote's 1418, Les Refus de la Guerre. And this is all. This is a collection about all the different ways that people tried to avoid the war. It was very difficult for them to oppose the war because there was no leadership and so on. But all the different ways of avoiding the war. And one of the things he says in here, which is quite interesting, is that if your group of soldiers, your battalion or something, were very, very effective and enthusiastic, you didn't live as long. Because the enthusiastic sections were immediately sent to the most dangerous places where they were most needed. Whereas a lazy group of soldiers, they would not be sent to the most dangerous places. So it was actually the most intelligent thing to be was a little bit lazy during the First World War, if you wanted to survive. This book, Social History, The Deluge, extremely influential book by Arthur Barrow, and I mentioned this because of the name, the Deluge. Yeah, the Deluge, of course, in the Bible, is an event which completely changes the history of the world. And so that's the when you use a word like that in the title of your book, you're making a very strong claim about it. This is one of the conservative historian's book, Forgotten Victory. So about the First World War, yeah. So what he's saying is everybody's forgotten it was a victory. So obviously that's very, very clearly political point of view. The First World War, myths and realities. Now, all of the books say myths and realities because, of course, you want to give the impression you're giving something new. And finally, this is recent. Retrouver la guerre. This is probably the most famous of the French historians, Annette Becker and Stéphane Audouin Rousseau. These are the two sides of the debate in France. Stéphane Audouin Rousseau and Annette Becker on one side for the culture of patriotic acceptance, and André Lhote on the other side for the idea that mainly people were pressured or constrained. Okay, what's next here? I'm not quite sure what's next. Yeah, recently, so what's coming out this year? You know, what can be new? Very often the new books that come out are not so new, but there you have a couple of them. British Children's Literature and the First World War, representations since 1914. So how in children's books, is there anybody here working on children's literature? Je savais que quand on était spécialiste en littérature juvénile, je crois qu'il y avait parmi vous, non? Okay, so this is obviously cultural history, history of representations. What do children's books say about the First World War since 1914? So you've got a corpus, 100 children's books since 1914, yeah, and that's their history history book. And this one, which is again cultural history by linguists, words of the First World War. Language, memory, vocabulary. What were the words which arrived during the First World War? You had 1.4 million Indian soldiers came to France from India to fight for the British Empire. And many Indian words came into the English language at this time because there were so many Indians around. Yeah. So that's a new 2017 books. Also 2017, here's two more. Female Tommies, the Frontline Women of the First World War. As the war continued, there were obviously a shortage of men, and this was dealt with in different ways. In Russia, they organized battalions of women soldiers. Only in Russia. Russia was the only country which organized battalions of women soldiers who fought in the same way as the men.
So that's very, very interesting. All of the other countries who were desperate for soldiers, Germany, France, Italy, that was too much. That was too much because would be changing the culture too much. But in Russia, they did do it. So that's interesting. In Russia, they actually had thousands of women soldiers, not mixed battalions now, but they had a women's battalion. But this is not really about fighters. This is, as there were fewer and fewer men, they were all needed for soldiers, then you got more and more women doing ancillary work on the front line, but telephone operators, clerks and so on, you know, other things on the front line. Elizabeth, that's just coming out this year. And another one here, British trench names of the Western Front. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but you know the trenches began in Switzerland and went all the way to Belgium. There's like 700 kilometres of trenches. And it was very easy to get lost. First of all, you don't have one straight trench because it's too dangerous. Because if an enemy arrives in the trench, they just can shoot everybody. So the trenches always go like this, because it's safer. Remember that if you're digging a trench. Okay, so that you didn't get lost, and there wasn't just one trench, there were lots of them. So they didn't get lost, they had names. The trenches had names. The soldiers invented names, like street names. But they invented them in humorous ways. The soldiers invented the names, and so it would be Rat Sally, etc., etc. There are hundreds and hundreds of the names, thousands of names. And so this guy has written a book about the names they used. It's a whole book just about the choice of names that they used. Still 2017. These are the books I haven't read. Magistrates in the Great War. So here we're with social history here, really. Choosing a particular social group, magistrates. Why not? Yeah, magistrates of the Great War. So magistrates, you imagine, would mostly be staying at... I think they're talking about the magistrates that stayed at home. And they had to... The advantage of studying magistrates is that everything is written down. Everything they do is written down. That's wonderful. Yeah. Whereas if you're a nurse, you don't write down everything you do. The magistrates had to decide who could be a conscientious objector and who could not be a conscientious objector. They would also be dealing with problems of rationing. At the end of the war, they introduced rationing. You know, so you're not allowed to buy unlimited quantities of meat. Each person can buy, I don't know, 200 grams of meat a week, something like that. Now, rationing is very important. Rationing is a democratic reform. Because in wartime, if you don't have rationing, only the rich buy meat. Because the prices just go up. There's not enough meat. The reason there's not enough meat is that the ships cannot arrive from Argentina with the meat. That's the problem here. So there's not enough meat. And people like meat. And if you don't have any government intervention, the prices go up. And only the rich can buy the meat. I mean, really, prices can be multiplied by 10. So rationing, in fact, was quite popular. We always imagine rationing as being something very annoying, but it was actually quite popular because it meant everybody would get a little bit of meat. So the magistrates. And the... From the dugouts to the trenches. Baseball during the Great War. It's always... Historians managed to find a new question. Baseball during the Great War. During the Great War, the American soldiers managed to introduce a little bit of baseball to France. But football was more popular. And the First World War helped football become massively popular in France. It was previously a fairly small thing. Whereas in Britain, after the 1880s, it was a national obsession. These ones from 2016. Humour, entertainment and popular culture during the First World War. I wrote one of the chapters there. The YMCA. Okay, the YMCA in the First World War. They established cafes and places just behind the front lines where people could rest, and also they would give paper and pens and stamps so you could write letters home. Or if you couldn't write, they would write your letter for you.
So a lot of the French peasants couldn't write. The English could write more because they were an urban civilization. But nevertheless, there were still quite a few who couldn't write. And this is a new area. 1916, a global history. So in one book, trying to include what is happening in Africa, Japan, South America, and Europe, because there are links. Even in South America, you don't think South America in the First World War, what did they do? You don't think they did much. But in fact, of course, they did, because with such a war, Argentina, for example, had to decide, were they going to sell to one side or to the other side? And of course, they could sell weapons and guns if they could make them, or uniforms if they could make them. They had it in factories. There's a lot of market there, a lot of money to be made. It can be difficult to sell to both sides because one side might decide to invade you or blockade you if you're selling to the other side. Yes, there's a lot of politics. So global history, this is a very strong new tendency, global history, because it has been said that that history books tend to concentrate on France, Britain, Germany, Italy, and not care about the rest of the world. And this is probably true. This is probably true. And humour, entertainment, popular culture, that's the first time we've had a book about humour. Very difficult, because first of all you have to define humour, which is not so easy to define. And in there's some stuff about Charlie Chaplin. Of course I wrote about humorous songs and so on. And 2018, next year, here are two things which are going to be produced. This is a new idea, I think. Five Phrases from Defeat, How Britain Nearly Lost the First World War. This is usually the case. Most wars are fairly closely fought. Because if you're going to lose terribly, then you don't start the war. So they're usually fairly closely fought, because you can only have a war if both sides think it's possible to win, normally. A war between states, in any case, so that's one. And here, this is a brand new one which I haven't seen yet, The Songs and Sounds. So this is a popular song in New Zealand. This is a popular song in New Zealand during the First World War. So that's from the publishing point of view. But what is happening in the universities? Well, I was, because very often you hear people complaining that there's too much cultural history and not enough military history these days. And so I thought I would have a look at the books. And this is the theses. So these are doctoral theses in universities. Yeah, the doctor, huh? Between 2000 and 2014, in British universities, exactly 103 theses were defended. Now, that's a very large number of doctoral theses, yeah? You remember you spend 3, 4, or 5 years writing one. So it's a huge number. And also, it's very easy to calculate the percentages when you have 103 theses. So these will show something about what subjects are popular in universities. This is not the same as the subjects which are popular in bookshops. If you're running a bookshop, you will sell mostly diaries of soldiers. That's what people love to buy. Diaries of soldiers, letters from soldiers. That's what people love to buy. But in the universities, this is the group you've got. So as you can see, if we divide them into military, social and cultural, we have 18. Oh, sorry. Ça en fait, c'est la version de l'année précédente. Alors, il n'y en a que 85 là. Et pas sans toi. Okay, so the 18 military and diplomatic history. So you can see that although this is the very first configuration that began many years ago, it still has a certain number, 18. It's not the most popular, but it does have a certain number. 28 social and political history, which includes 6 political history, 12 social history, and 6 medical history. That's quite a lot, yeah, really, because medical history, obviously medical is a small, so that's quite a rising field. 6 of the theses were about medical history. But by far the biggest
field is cultural history. 42 doctoral theses in cultural history, including 4 in gender studies, yeah, about masculinity and femininity. 15 general cultural history, whatever that is. 6 about women writers or novelists or poets, etc. And this is something I mentioned. We have a lot of writings about what women wrote, and not so many about what happened to women, about people who women who were not writers. It's a slight strange. 5 history of culture probably, and 11. This is quite a lot. 11 for history and commemoration. Yeah. So that's the ones we've got. So what kind of subject do we have? Well, military history includes. The policy of the Netherlands, who were neutral, the attitude of the British state towards Zionism, things like that. But there's also military history from below, the life of ordinary soldiers. For example, there's a thesis on food and a thesis on attitude to death among German and British soldiers. That would be that's very much cultural history, because it's really representation, yeah, attitude to death. Were people fatalistic? I know in Britain, in the Second World War, people were very fatalistic. They said, the bomb, if the bomb has your name on it, there's nothing you can do. There was a very, very, people used to say that a lot. I wasn't there, yeah, this is what my mother told me. Okay. Political history included books about the Conservative Party in Wales and the Conservative Party in Newcastle. Yes, that's the sort of thing you see in political history. In social history, you get a doctorate about German immigrants in Glasgow, another about Catholics in the First World War, and another about Indian soldiers, and another about war widows. Yeah, what was life like for the women who lost their husbands? As I said, surprisingly, 6 deal with medical history, 4 of them with what we call shell shock at the time, and today we would say syndrome de stress post-traumatique. Yeah, so 4 theses on that. In gender studies, we had Jamaica, masculinity and the Great War. Donc, comment la masculinité a été utilisée pour des objectifs de recrutement au Jamaïque. La masculinité héroïque en Grande-Bretagne entre 1915 et 1937. Okay, so I have a little bit more detail here. I just wanted to end with saying what is not present, because if you look at the theses, these 103 theses, doctoral theses, studied or defended in British universities, there are a number of subjects which you do not find. For example, work, life at work, and trade unionism are not present at all. British colonies are absent, except for 1 thesis about India's. Very, very little about Britain's colonies, even though India sent 1.4 million soldiers. Yeah, British people don't even know, actually, that happened. And very, very, almost no comparative themes. Les thèses qui font une comparaison entre 2 pays différents, rarissime, je crois qu'il y en a un. So really, historians have remained very national and national-orientated, that is to say, British historians write about Britain, French historians write about France, and that's not always the case. That's why I pointed out this new idea of global history, but that's still very strongly the case. Very, very strongly the case. And so somebody said this about it, Pierre Persegel said, les approches transnationales et comparées demeurent trop rares. soucieux d'explorer, si ce n'est de célébrer l'exception britannique, le primat du cadre national obère finalement une meilleure compréhension de l'expérience britannique du conflit.
Okay, so I've gone through the different kinds of history that you can write, some of the new things which people are doing, and what people are doing at the university. And so that's the end of that story. And next week I'm going to start looking at memory and commemoration. Thank you for your attention.